Disc 13.
Johnson's attitude had again unleashed Homer Capehart, who now gave Olds perhaps more credit for the overall growth of international communism in the 20th century than he deserved. "Don't you feel," Capehart asked, "that as a result of the articles in which you praised Russia, that made some contribution to the fact that the world pretty much is going communistic today and socialistic?" Olds said he didn't think so, but Capehart would not allow such false modesty to go uncorrected. Olds's article on the Soviet system being beneficial to children, "You do not think maybe that had some effect on helping to communize that portion of the world which had been communized or socialized?" "We have a lot of it in this country," Capehart said. "A lot of what?" Olds asked. "A lot of people who believed in the so-called Soviet system." "I have not seen many of them, Senator. You have not been looking for them, but there are a lot." Leland Olds was eventually allowed to finish reading his statement, every word of it. For over an hour that afternoon, as Capehart and Johnson cross-examined him, the remaining pages lay unread before him. When the cross-examination was completed, Capehart rose and left the hearing room, along with the other senators who had been present. The dais was empty except for Lyndon Johnson. There was no other senator present to hear Olds's statement, and then Johnson allowed him to read. After a while, as he was reading, some of the other senators returned. But by this time Olds was dealing not with communism, but with his record on the FPC. As they sat on the dais, the senators chatted with each other or leaned back and whispered to their assistants. As the New Republic commented, Olds's FPC record was of so little interest to committee members that they scarcely listened to his prepared testimony. After Olds finally completed his testimony, Johnson began calling other witnesses. Those testifying on Olds's behalf received treatment no more sympathetic than the chairman had given the man they were defending. When Olds's fellow FPC commissioner Thomas C. Buchanan testified that Olds was a good judge, who listens patiently, considers soberly, weighs wisely, and judges impartially, Johnson asked, "Do you really believe that last statement you made?" And when Buchanan said he did, "very much so," Johnson's response was to try to show that Buchanan hadn't known Olds very long. Actually, Buchanan said, he had known and worked with him for 10 years. When the elderly George S. Reed, a longtime member of the New York State Power Authority, said that he had worked with Olds for 15 years and praised his single-minded devotion to the ideals of democracy, Johnson could scarcely contain himself and tried to make Reed say that he held an opinion equally favorable about other FPC commissioners. Refusing to be bullied, Reed said, "Well, I was speaking particularly on account of Mr. Olds." Johnson got the newspaper coverage he wanted. Only a handful of reporters had attended the hearings, and most newspapers relied on the article from the United Press. Reprinted the next morning, Thursday, September 29th, in newspapers across the country, it led with Senator Reed's statement that Olds was a full-fledged, first-class communist, and used the word admits, with its implication of guilt, in describing Olds's testimony, referring to articles which Mr. Olds admitted writing. Commissioner Olds, confronted with the documents, admitted they were radical. And over the article were the headlines Johnson wanted, headlines which contained the key word. "Senator Reed hits Olds as communist," reported the country's most influential newspaper, the New York Times, above a subhead. "FPC member up for a new term admits radical writing of 1929. In the Washington Post headline, the key word was shortened. "Senator says writings point to Olds as red." Olds's friends had anticipated that the communist charges brought up in 1944 would be raised again. The money, natural gas profits, involved was so big that you couldn't believe that these people were going to let it go, John Gunther, the ADA lobbyist, not the writer, recalls. Even so, largely unaware of Johnson's pre-hearing maneuvering, they felt the attack would again fail and hadn't taken the hearings seriously. But on that Wednesday afternoon, Gunther received a telephone call from a fellow liberal, who asked, "Were you at the hearings this morning?" Gunther said he had not been. "My God," the friend said, "they're taking Olds's hide off. They're really out to get him." Late that afternoon, a group of Olds's admirers met and discussed plans for his defense. The next morning's newspapers had not yet appeared, and for a few hours they were optimistic. "We still hadn't had McCarthy," Gunther says. Joe McCarthy's speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, which brought his red-hunting career to national attention, would not be given until February 1950. "So I thought, this," Johnson's attack, "isn't going to work. The guy, Olds, is too well respected for this. They, the other senators, are not going to take this seriously." The optimism was briefly reinforced the next morning by the Washington Post's editorial, which attacked Representative Lyle's despicable and preposterous attempt to smear Mr. Olds as a Red, and by Lowell Mellett, perhaps the only columnist besides Othman to attend the Wednesday hearings, who ridiculed the point introduced by Johnson. After reporting that, "I found the hearing had been launched as a trial of Mr. Olds as a former and perhaps unreformed communist," that "the air was charged with emotion or a reasonable appearance of same," and that "the subcommittee members were being, quote, shocked," unquote, to their manifest delight, by the Federated Press articles, Mellett wrote sarcastically that "there was something worse." The Daily Worker reported his appearance once on the same platform with Earl Browder, the chairman of the Communist Party. That really hit the senators hard. "I am shocked," said Senator McFarland of Arizona. "Shocked beyond words." Which, in the case of a senator, could be a third-degree shock, possibly fatal. But the sturdy Arizonan rose to his feet and departed for the Senate chamber, apparently not wishing to hear any more. If Senator McFarland had detoured by way of the Congressional Library and asked for a copy of Elizabeth Dilling's book, The Roosevelt Red Record and Its Background, he'd have got a shock that would have finished him. On page 59, he would have found a picture of Earl Browder taken with four men with whom he had just shared the platform at a meeting of the American Youth Congress. And who is the smiling gentleman sitting in the middle? None other than the senior senator from Ohio, Mr. Taft. But their optimism, which of course vanished as telephone reports about the newspaper coverage across the country came in, was not shared by Leland Olds. In front of the subcommittee, Olds had maintained an air of confidence. When, late that afternoon, he got back to the FPC building, however, he went into his office with his wife and his assistant and shut the door. "And then he slumped in his chair," Melwood Vanskoyak recalls. "He was always such a buoyant guy, but he just sat there, slumped, as if he was defeated. He asked Maud not to come to the hearings the next day, but she insisted that she would." Late that afternoon, Lyndon Johnson shut the door to his office because he had some telephone calls to make. Olds's inability to remember the date of his resignation from the American Labor Party, which many senators believed was a communist front, had hardened the suspicions of the senators on the subcommittee, and Johnson wanted the circle with suspicions to be widened. Telephoning other senators, he said he was calling just to keep them informed on the hearings, and included in his information the fact that the man they were being asked to confirm had been a member of the ALP, and that, while Olds contended that he had resigned, he somehow couldn't say when. Johnson left the impression that Olds was lying, his tone by turns joking and confidential. Busby and Jenkins, opening the door, saw him with his feet up on his desk, big hand around the receiver, laughing as he described how the witness had squirmed when asked for a date. If, after Olds had provided the date the next day, Johnson telephoned the senators again to correct the impression, none of his staff heard him do so. The next day's hearing, the final day scheduled, began with the testimony of pro-Olds witnesses. Johnson hurried them along, and at the conclusion of each witness's testimony simply thanked him, asking no questions. As the pro-Olds witnesses testified, Johnson's bearing was impatient. Several times he pulled out a large stopwatch and looked at it ostentatiously. This technique was successful because of the thoroughness with which the subcommittee had been stacked, so that there was not even one senator present who was sympathetic to Olds. Joseph P. Harris, a University of California political scientist who was later to analyze the Olds hearings in detail, wrote that witnesses favoring the nomination were treated politely but were usually asked no questions. Quite a different public impression would have been made had there been a single member of the subcommittee to ask searching questions of both sides. One of the witnesses refused to be hurried. She was Ann K. Alpern, who, during 7 years as Pittsburgh's city attorney, had earned a reputation as a determined opponent of utility monopolies. Noting that the Senate had confirmed Olds twice before, she told the senators, "You have the same set of facts now as then. There is nothing new. Nothing is involved but the same set of facts. They have been brought up here. They have been hashed and rehashed and regurgitated. I think it is unfair." Aware that a telling point was being made, Johnson tried to cut her off. "If we spend our time considering what happened in 1940 or 1944, we will never get through. Proceed, Miss Alpern." But she faced him down. "Well," she said, "I hope that the senators will ask me some questions, because I think the only way by which anyone has an opportunity to present a point of view is through questions." As she proceeded to praise Olds as a courageous public servant, "The courageous ones are the ones who are decapitated. That is why I think this confirmation is so very important. If you do not confirm Mr. Olds, men in high positions will be fearful of taking a stand." Other subcommittee members asked hostile questions. Johnson pulled out his watch and kept it out, staring at it as she talked. Then, breaking into her argument and giving her a hard stare, he said, "Miss Alpern, you have consumed the time allotted to you." Staring back at Johnson, Miss Alpern said, "Well, Senator, my time has been divided a little unequally between me and the members of the committee." Johnson then allowed her to finish. "We, the consumers of the country, have a great deal of difficulty in fighting utilities matters. We do not have the money, we do not have the staff. We need men like Mr. Olds," she said. Some of the pro-Olds testimony was quite eloquent. After explaining that Olds's efforts had forced natural gas companies to refund the more than $8 million they had overcharged Kansas City residents in their monthly bills, City Attorney David M. Proctor quoted a recent Kansas City Star editorial. "Human memory and gratitude are short, but a few persons in this area have reason to remember Leland Olds." The testimony came from witnesses representing both labor unions. William J. Houston of the American Federation of Government Employees called Olds a man of humanity, and farmers. "Any criticism reflects more on the critic than on Mr. Olds," said J.T. Sanders of the National Grange. Recalling the hearing years later, Banskoyak was to write of the numerous expressions by persons in his, Olds's, favor. But Banskoyak was also to write, "These expressions were overwhelmed by expressions of hatred. For the witnesses who supported Olds were followed by the witnesses who opposed him, the witnesses Lyndon Johnson had selected with such care, the witnesses he had secretly met with and coached. Lyndon Johnson wanted words in headlines equally as devastating as communist or red, and in these witnesses he had men who would provide headline writers with the words he wanted." Two of them, South Texas attorneys linked to natural gas interests, were as unlike in appearance as they were similar in their violent anti-communism. William N. Bonner of Houston, burly and braggadocious, had a beaming grin. Hayden Head of Corpus Christi, stony-faced and thin-lipped, kept his hair cropped close to his skull and his posture as rigidly erect as if he were constantly at attention in a military drill. Already known throughout corrupt South Texas as the man with the black bag, because of his political fund-dispensing activities on behalf of Maston Nixon of Southern Minerals and other ultra-conservative Rio Valley moguls, Head was rabid in his racism. "We never celebrate Lincoln's birthday," he boasted, and in his hatred of Reds, which would lead him to found Citizens Alert, an organization to remind America of the threat of world communism. Johnson had been particularly impressed with Head. After a long interview with the attorney, he had wired Maston Nixon, "I'm sure he will be invaluable." Johnson had spent a lot of time coaching Bonner, but now, when he called Bonner to the witness table, he looked around the room as if he had never seen him before. "Mr. William N. Bonner," Johnson said, "is Mr. Bonner present?" As it happened, Mr. Bonner was, and taking his seat at the witness table, he testified that Leland Olds was a traitor to our country, a crackpot, and a jackass wholly unfit to make rules. That the Federated Press was a communistic sheet whose articles were published each week by the Daily Worker. And that Olds does not deny speaking from the same platform with Earl Browder. "Every public utterance which this punk has uttered, every final position which he has taken, shows beyond cavil that he would, if permitted, substitute security and statism for freedom and opportunity," Bonner said. Hayden Head had been saved as the last witness, for Head was the climax. He said Olds was a communist and also an intellectual, which made him all the more dangerous. He is a much greater threat to the American way of life than he would be if his brain were less agile. And Head implied, sitting at attention in the witness chair, that Mr. Olds might also be something more, a communist agent, who had turned from writing to bureaucratic administration to accomplish his aims from within the government, an agent using the power he had obtained as a high governmental official to advance the communist conspiracy, to destroy free enterprise, the capitalistic system, and American freedom. "Do you realize, gentlemen of the committee," Head asked, "that Leland Olds, clothed in the mantle of respectability, of high public office, both state and federal, has continued without appreciable intermission the pursuit of those objectives which he advocated 20 years ago in the columns of the Daily Worker? He has done it slowly, yes, but insidiously, delicately, step by step, but relentlessly and persistently." And, Head declared, Olds had already accomplished much of his agenda. "The entire history of his administration in the Federal Power Commission can well be characterized as a bite-by-bite process. How far away is the last juicy bite, the destruction of the myth of private property?" During his 10 years on the FPC, Head declared, Olds had been indoctrinating the FPC with the tenets of, shall we say, communistic, or shall we say, identical with communistic thoughts. That is evident in his writings of the '20s. Why should Mr. Olds continue to write for the Federated Press, for the Daily Worker, for Industrial Solidarity, when he can write for the Federal Power Commission and accomplish much more? Mr. Olds is boring from within. Mr. Olds is a termite. Mr. Olds is gnawing away the very foundations upon which this government exists. Who knew, Head asked, how far such hidden communistic influence might extend? The elements in this country which support the philosophy which Mr. Olds represents are stronger than I had realized, he said. There was, for example, the Washington Post, which, as I understand, is what is called one of your more advanced papers. In the Post, there appear the writings of a man by the name of Childs, Head noted. Marquis Childs's attacks on the Natural Gas Act, he said, seem strangely reminiscent of the words of Mr. Olds, and are part of the greatest organized campaign of propaganda that I have ever witnessed. Not only Childs, but a man by the name of Mellett, I believe, and another man by the name of Stokes have been in the forefront of the attack. And, Head declared, this morning the apex of misrepresentation occurred. He was referring to the editorial in the Washington Post, which called John Lyle's testimony despicable because of its attempt to smear Mr. Olds as a Red. The editorial, Head said, was the culmination of this propaganda campaign waged by Mr. Olds's machine. No greater pack of lies has ever existed than that. The Post editorial had evidently struck a nerve, not only with Head, but with the subcommittee's chairman, and Mellett's column was a danger signal. What if other liberal columnists, the columnists who had believed that Lyndon Johnson was a liberal, appeared at the hearings and saw what Mellett had seen? To telephone calls from liberal friends Wednesday evening inquiring about the reports they had been hearing, Johnson assured them that the reports were incorrect. Olds had indeed been labeled a communist, he said, but not by him. On the contrary, he told the callers, he had attempted to stop such smears. He told the callers to come to the hearings and see for themselves. Lyndon Johnson's behavior that Thursday morning was, for a time, as studiously impartial as it had been, for a time, after Wednesday's Stokes and Othman columns had appeared. He repeatedly attempted to document the even-handedness with which he had conducted the hearings by emphasizing that any witness, whether pro or anti-Olds, would be allowed to appear. "I just want to be sure that the record shows that every man who wanted to say anything had his say," he declared at one point. He even attempted to distance himself from the most violent aspects of Bonner's testimony, thereby decrying in public the very words he had approved in private. "Now, Mr. Bonner," he admonished him at one point during his testimony, "there is no testimony before this committee that Mr. Olds was a member of the Communist Party. There is no one who testified that he is disloyal to his government. As a matter of fact, we had witnesses all day yesterday who talked about how loyal he had been." Bonner would shortly be writing to Dear Lyndon to compliment you on the very able manner in which the entire hearing was conducted, and to gloat over his testimony's success in producing headlines. Half the states quoted my own statement, particularly the expression punk, which I used. During the testimony of Auntie Old's witnesses, the chairman's stopwatch remained in his pocket. Even though Head's testimony consumed more time than he had requested, Johnson made no reference to time consumed. And during Bonner's testimony, the chairman departed from his previous practice. The Houston attorney had come equipped with his own photostat, a typed 4-page summary, provenance unknown, of information from the files of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Subject, Leland Olds. Bonner, holding the photostat out to Johnson, asked that it be made a part of the record. When other witnesses had presented exhibits with a similar request, Johnson had simply said, "Without objection, it will be made a part of the record," and had indicated that the documents should be handed to a committee clerk. But with this exhibit, perhaps because Senator Bricker, who was particularly susceptible to HUAC information and who had been out of town, had just made his first appearance at the hearing and could not be relied on to read through the transcript of previous testimony, Johnson, before handing this exhibit to a clerk, said, "For the benefit of the committee, I will read the article into the record," and did so, every word. Only after 10 minutes of his recitation, in Report 1311 of the Special Committee on Un-American Activities, dated March 29, 1944, the Federated Press was cited as a communist-controlled organization. In the Report of the Special Committee on Un-American Activities, dated January 3, 1939, the Trade Union Educational League was cited as a project put under control of and made amenable to the Central Executive Committee of the Communist Party of America. Did Johnson add a disclaimer? Now, I will say that the testimony yesterday by Mr. Olds covered most of the references. Mr. Olds testified that he never belonged to the Communist Party. He got the reaction from Bricker he wanted, both then. He did not deny any of this charge then on page 4, and at the end of the hearings, when Head was winding up his testimony. "In conclusion, I say this," Head declared. "Leland Olds is a fraud. He is a fraud on his friends who appeared here in his behalf. He is a fraud on the consuming public whom he fills with misleading statements. He is a fraud on the press whom he fills with misleading statements, and he is a fraud on the people of the United States of America." "It is a good, strong, positive statement, certainly," said Senator Bricker. And Johnson again got the headlines he wanted. Newspapers in states across the country did indeed, as Bonner boasted, carry some version of his statement. A headline in the Houston Post, for example, said, "Leland Olds labeled crackpot and traitor." The attorney's colorful phrases, along with Head's, provided rich grist for newspapers predisposed to be hostile to Olds, enlivening the articles under the headlines. The first sentence in the Philadelphia Inquirer's article informed readers that Leland Olds, President Truman's choice for a third term on the Federal Power Commission, today was branded a punk, a crackpot, a jackass, and a traitor by a witness before the Senate Commerce Committee. "Denounced as a traitor to his country," reported the Chicago Tribune. Johnson had allowed only 2 full days for the hearings, and his emphasis on dispatch was perhaps explained by a remark he made to other subcommittee members Thursday afternoon. "The rumor has gone around today that maybe the proponents would like to continue the hearing on into next week sometime until they get some more articles written and things like that." By taking Olds's supporters by surprise, he had kept them from mobilizing support behind the embattled commissioner. He didn't want to give them time to mobilize now. A stumbling block now appeared in the road to speedy conclusion, however. Olds asked for a chance to reply to the charges against him. He had asked on Wednesday as he was rising from the witness chair, and Johnson had said, "I think that can be worked out." Johnson's idea of working it out, however, involved speed. The rest of the hearings would wind up Thursday afternoon. Olds could reply, Johnson said, on Saturday morning. But when, on Thursday, Olds asked the committee clerk for the transcript of Lyle's testimony and the exhibits upon which it was based, the 54 Federated Press articles, he was informed they would not be available until sometime Friday. Olds thereupon wrote to Johnson requesting a postponement until the following Wednesday. The material selected by Representative Lyle purports to be selected from articles which I wrote more than 20 years ago, and which number some 1,800, he said. To have such material thrust upon me at a moment's notice, and without an opportunity to relate the selected articles to my work, placed me in a position in which I could make no adequate comment. I am therefore writing to you to renew my request for opportunity to study the record and to make such answers as I believe necessary in a public hearing. Reasonable though Olds's request may have seemed, however, it was not to be granted. Rather than replying to Olds himself, Johnson had a Commerce Committee clerk, Edward Cooper, do it. At 7 o'clock Thursday night, Cooper telephoned Olds that the schedule would not be changed. His reply was still scheduled for 10 a.m. Saturday, and Cooper made clear that there would also be no change in the schedule for providing him with the transcript on which the reply would be based. That would still not be available until sometime Friday. Olds was being given 24 hours or less to prepare his defense. There was what Olds was to call a big heap of Federated Press clippings in his house on McKinley Street in Northwest Washington, but he hadn't looked at them in years, and they had just been tied together haphazardly. Merely to sort through them and to arrange them in some kind of order would take hours. And he knew he didn't have many, perhaps most, of the articles Lyle had cited. It had taken teams of investigators weeks of sorting through copies of old newspapers and libraries to compile a complete file for the prosecution. Following Cooper's call, Olds worked until midnight Thursday sorting through the clippings and arose to continue at 5:30 Friday morning, still without having seen the transcript to which his defense was supposed to reply. As the impossibility of preparing an adequate defense by Saturday became apparent, Olds telephoned Johnson to plead for more time. "I had asked for Wednesday," he said. "If that was impossible, I feel that in justice I should have until Monday to get this answer ready. I am appealing to you to let me have until Monday." "I talked to the subcommittee before I called," Johnson replied. "Some of them will be out of town Monday. They suggested you take Saturday." When Olds obstinately balked at this suggestion, Johnson casually unveiled a threat. "Of course," he said, "if Olds insisted on submitting additional material, Lyle would testify again and submit additional material himself. He said he had some pretty recent statements and will come back with some more comparisons," Johnson said. "Said he had some more of your views he would like to read into the record." And Johnson insisted firmly on his own point of view. When Olds mentioned the voluminous record he had to study, Johnson said the issue was actually quite simple. "The subcommittee's viewpoint," he said, "is that there are some 50 articles and that you either wrote them or you did not. It shouldn't take any time to decide that." When Olds said that the White House wants me to deal with this thing as fully as I think I ought to, Johnson replied, "You either wrote the article or you did not. We put the page and paragraph and you can check them." "It's not as simple as that," Olds said. It was not he who objected to delay, Johnson said, but other members of the subcommittee. "As far as I'm concerned, I will have no objection. I will recommend it. I want to be as fair as I can. I will treat you just as I would want you to treat me if the positions were reversed. I will talk to them, and if I can get them to be agreeable, I will let you know." Later, Johnson called back and said that the subcommittee had agreed to the Monday date. "Well, you are very kind," Leland Olds said, "and I appreciate what the others did very much, too." He wouldn't have the 5 days he had asked, a meager enough time to defend a lifetime's work, but at least he would have a whole weekend. "At the outset, I want to state simply and categorically that I am not a communist," Olds said on Monday morning. "I never was a communist. I am and always have been loyal to my country. I am and always have been a profound believer in democracy. In my opinion, the very theory of Russian communism represents a negation of democracy." "I did write radically during the period publicized by Mr. Lyle," Olds said. "I did so because I believed radical writing was needed in the golden 20s to shock the American people, and particularly labor, out of social and political lethargy. I felt that unless the American people were aroused to do something about it, the American way of life would be in real jeopardy." Olds's prepared statement then would have gone on to analyze one by one the articles which Lyle claimed showed his alien philosophy. But Johnson may have been working that weekend too, with the man who said, First ask him this, then ask him if he... Hardly had Olds begun reading this analysis when Johnson cut him off. Cut him off with questions that applied to the articles as a single group, and in the broadest, most simple, or to be more precise, simplistic, terms. "Mr. Olds," he demanded, leaning forward across the dais and speaking in a very soft tone in which every word was carefully enunciated, "do you repudiate those writings?" And when Olds said he didn't, Johnson asked, "Do you reiterate them? Do you reassert them?" "Mr. Olds, I am going to discuss those writings in terms of Mr. Lyle's presentation and tell you exactly what those writings mean." Senator Johnson, "We are going to be able to judge what they mean. We will be glad to have your viewpoint upon what they mean, but the question I want to ask you, do you still feel as you did when you wrote those articles?" Mr. Olds, "No, I have indicated that the change in the circumstances in this country, and the change in my thinking that has gone along with it, would lead me to write some of those articles in a somewhat different way today." Senator Johnson, "But there has been a change in your thinking since those articles were written?" Mr. Olds, "There has been a change in my thinking." Senator Johnson, "Then you do repudiate certain things you said then?" Mr. Olds, "I do not repudiate them as said at that time in terms of my relationship to that period in which I was writing." Repeatedly, as Olds attempted to explain the points he had been trying to make during the 1920s, Johnson would cut in, demanding that he either repudiate or reassert them. Repeatedly, Olds would try to explain to Johnson that the situation was not as simple as the question made it appear. His thinking had changed, he said over and over, but those writings represented what his thinking had been at the time. He still believed that they represented his thinking at the time. For example, "I did not think then, and I do not think now, that private enterprise in the 1920s was providing a decent family wage or assurance of security or even protection." And he said he therefore could not honestly repudiate them. But simplicity was what Johnson was interested in. Over and over, when Olds attempted to explain what he had meant by an article, how it related to the times in which it had been written, or how its meaning had been altered by changes in political or economic conditions, Johnson would cut in, demanding that he either repudiate what he had written or reiterate it. Whoever framed that question, Alvin Wirtz, Horace Busby, Lyndon Johnson himself, could be proud of its effectiveness, for it placed Olds again in a trap. Refusal to repudiate a specific article could be interpreted to mean that the witness still held the beliefs expressed in it. If he said he did repudiate the article, his repudiation could be taken as proof that he was indeed a chameleon, willing to express any view that would keep him in power, so that he could further his secret communistic aims. Had Olds been allowed actually to deal with the articles Lyle had quoted, his answers would have been definitive. "The articles may have been carried in the Daily Worker," he said, "but they had not been written for the Daily Worker, but for the Federated Press subscribers in general, and many other non-communist papers had carried them." In a further demonstration of Johnson's sophistry and of Johnson's sensitivity to criticism, when Olds said this, the chairman turned to the other senators, made a palms-up gesture of injured innocence, and said, "The committee has not charged him, and so far as I know, no other witness has charged him with being an employee of the Daily Worker, and we do not want the country to get the impression that he has been so charged." Olds said that he had not even written one article Lyle had cited, charging that in it Olds had publicized a school for communists, urging the comrades to attend. That article was indeed damaging, Olds said, but, he said, in a statement never thereafter challenged by Lyle, the HUAC investigators, Lyndon Johnson, or anyone else, he had not written that article. He had never seen it before. But Olds almost never got to make his points in an uninterrupted, coherent way. When, for example, he attempted to explain what he had meant when he wrote during the 1920s of the necessity for labor to obtain increased political power, Johnson said, "I'm not asking you what you meant, I'm asking you what you said." "I made that statement, yes," Olds replied. "You repudiate it today?" Johnson demanded. "I repudiate it in the sense in which it is understood by you gentlemen," Olds said. "I'm not saying what the understanding is, I'm asking, do you repudiate or do you reiterate it?" "I would repudiate it," Olds said. "What I was trying to describe is still going on, but I think I would repudiate today the way I said it then. I would say it in different terms today, if that is what you mean. More than an hour after Olds resumed the witness stand, with his written statement barely begun, Johnson was still employing this tactic. The question the committee is considering is, what did you say? Did you say it? If so, do you repeat it today? If you said them, say so. If you believe them, say so. You have a right to say that, and thank God in this country a man can still exercise some free speech. At that point, Senator McFarland stepped in, as he had done on the first day of Olds's testimony, saying, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest that probably the best way would be for us to, nearly as we can, let Mr. Olds finish his statement in chief, and then we would go back and bring up anything that we wanted in the nature that the chairman has suggested. I believe that he ought to get in the record, in any way that he wants to, his explanation, and then come back to the questions. Only then did the pace of the interruptions slacken. They never stopped completely, sufficiently so that 2 hours later Olds could get to the end of his statement. The repudiate or reiterate tactic was effective with conservative journalists. Some of them, like nationally syndicated columnist Gould Lincoln, felt they knew how to interpret Olds's refusal to repudiate. Mr. Olds himself told the Senate committee that he would have written the articles differently today, but he did not recant. This raises again the issue whether the administration is inclined to be soft with the Reds and fellow travelers. Other conservative journalists felt Olds had recanted, and they knew how to interpret that. Calling him chameleon-minded, the Dallas Morning News editorialized that he no longer thinks along radical lines, only because he is in power. But what guarantee have we of what his thinking will be tomorrow? The editorial asked. The tactic was effective also with the subcommittee members. As a Time correspondent explained, some of its members felt that he is a radical and that he switches position and policy with rapid facility, while others were angered by his refusal to switch. He had plenty of chances to renounce his inflammatory writings, but he declined to do so. That did weigh heavily against him. The subcommittee had been carefully selected for its susceptibility to testimony about Leland Olds's radicalism, and the effect of that testimony had been as powerful as even Lyndon Johnson could have wished, as was proven when, the following morning, Tuesday, October 4th, its 7 members met in Lyndon Johnson's office to cast their votes on the nomination. For the president had decided to fight for his nominee. After hearing a summary of the previous day's testimony, he had written a letter to Commerce Committee Chairman Ed Johnson, and the Coloradan read it to the subcommittee. "I am aware of the efforts that have been made to discredit Mr. Olds before your committee," Harry Truman wrote, and it was because of those efforts that he was writing. "Because of the nature of the opposition that has been expressed to his confirmation, nothing has been presented in testimony there which raises any doubt in my mind as to his integrity, loyalty, or ability," Truman said. "Much that has been said about him is largely beside the point. The issue before us is not whether we agree with everything Mr. Olds may have ever said, or even whether we agree with all of his actions as a member of the Federal Power Commission. The issue is whether his whole record is such as to lead us to believe that he will serve the nation well as a member of the Federal Power Commission." On that issue, Truman said, the record is clear. During 10 years on the commission, he has served ably and loyally. He is a nationally recognized champion of effective utility regulation. His record shows that he is also a champion of fair regulation. During those years, Truman said, Olds has made enemies. Powerful corporations, subject to regulation by the commission, have not been pleased with Mr. Olds. They now seek to prevent his confirmation for another term. It would be most unfortunate if they should succeed. We cannot allow great corporations to dominate the commissions which have been created to regulate them. Ed Johnson had received Truman's letter the previous evening, had discussed it with Lyndon Johnson, and a reply had been drafted. It might have been, and perhaps was, drafted by the same hand that had drafted Lyle's testimony, so closely did it follow its theme. The president might feel, Mr. Wisdom wrote him, that Olds's articles were beside the point, but the subcommittee begged to disagree. The subcommittee, he said, was shocked beyond description by the views expressed by Olds some years ago. He would, he said, include herewith a few excerpts, and he quoted several of the paragraphs Lyle had quoted. Certainly Olds had sounded sincere in claiming that his views had evolved, Ed Johnson said. That was another reason for distrusting him. The committee found Mr. Olds glib of tongue and very convincing. Like many crusaders for foreign ideologies, he has an attractive personality and is disarming to a very high degree. Despite the presence of four Democrats, members of the President's party, on the subcommittee, its vote on a resolution, introduced by Lyndon Johnson, to report the presidential nomination to the full committee with the recommendation that it be rejected, was a unanimous 7-0. The next day, as the New York Times reported, President Truman's earnest appeal for the confirmation of Leland Olds for a third term as Federal Power Commissioner fell on deaf ears again, when the full Commerce Committee voted 10-2 against the nominee. When a telegram announcing the committee vote was read to a meeting of the International Petroleum Association of America in Fort Worth, the 800 oil and natural gas producers in attendance broke into cheers and rebel yells. The reaction was different in Washington, in those precincts of Washington in which Lyndon Johnson had for so long held himself forth as a liberal, as the protege of Franklin Roosevelt, as a crusader against the forces of conservatism in Texas. The first reaction was shock, for so thoroughly had the preparations been concealed that it was only as the subcommittee and committee took their votes that the liberal community woke up fully to what had been done. "What a subcommittee!" the New Republic exclaimed. "It's been packed. They even brought in Bricker and Capehart. If we were a defendant in Russia and saw such a mackerel-eyed bunch as that looking down at us from the bench, we'd start writing confessions quick." Then there was outrage over the way in which it had been done, over the methods used to reject Olds, the communist smear. As the New Republic put it, "Olds," shouts the Senate committee, shaking the yellowed pages of newspapers 20 years old, "is the glib salesman of a foreign ideology." Who then are the Americans? Olds is the product of New England's Protestant conscience, of social work in Boston slums, and of Pennsylvania steel strikes, of Frank Walsh and Franklin Roosevelt. The views Olds had held in the 1920s were views so many liberals had held, liberals pointed out. "I know a few men worth their intellectual salt who didn't have some of the doubts Olds had at the time," Max Lerner said. In an editorial in the Washington Post, Alan Barth wrote that, like many a young man, he, Olds, was in a great hurry to reform the world and said some extravagant things in his column 25 years ago. Taken out of context and looked at it in the light of today's relationship between left and right, they may be made to seem extremely radical. But the social conditions of 25 years ago invited radicalism. A man could denounce open-shop capitalism in those days without being called a communist or being considered disloyal to the United States. The elder La Follette did so. And Olds's views were not the true reason for the campaign against him, which was, the nation said, actually a vendetta, a flagrant attempt by vested interests to exclude from office a man who proved too consumer-minded to suit their purposes. The real issue was the immense profits to be made from natural gas, I.F. Stone explained. This is the reason for the fight on Olds. If he had been willing to knuckle under on the issue, he would have been forgiven the authorship of Das Kapital itself. But these liberal writers knew the campaign had been successful, frighteningly successful. As Lerner put it, once the issue of Olds as one-time devil was raised, no one dared line up on his side. The hunting of dangerous thought has overridden every other quest. None of the senators dared to take a chance that someday an opponent would accuse him of having voted for a man who had once criticized our master institution of corporate power. And these writers understood the larger implications of that success. No one in the government service is safe unless he played an intellectual Caspar Milquetoast from the moment he left his teens, Lerner declared. The Olds case was teaching Washington that all a lobbyist has to do is dig up something vaguely pink or crimson in a recalcitrant official's past to ruin him, I.F. Stone said. As the Christian Science Monitor reported, it is hardly surprising that the case of Leland Olds has embittered Washington as few such cases have in recent years. And as awareness grew of Lyndon Johnson's role in the campaign, increasingly the liberals' bitterness began to be directed against him. for many of them were now coming to believe that Lyndon Johnson had betrayed them. The awareness had grown slowly. His friends had not previously focused on the fact that he was the chairman of the subcommittee against which they were raging. But now, criticizing the subcommittee for being so hostile to Olds that it resembles the House Un-American Activities Committee under J. Parnell Thomas, the New Republic rectified the omission with a vengeance. In an editorial entitled The Enemies of Leland Olds, the magazine said that against Olds is a one-time liberal senator, Lyndon Johnson, born into the family of a poor farmer, brought forward by the New Deal and carried into office by liberal and labor support. Johnson, who saw his first backer, Aubrey Williams, hounded out of government on charges of communism, now is hounding Olds out on the same charges. Johnson, who boasted that Roosevelt was a daddy to me. How Roosevelt would have scorned such backsliding. Increasingly, in newspaper articles and editorials, the subcommittee was identified as Johnson's subcommittee. Over the weekend, during which Olds was sorting frantically through ancient clippings, trying to assemble his defense, a new issue of Fortune magazine appeared on Washington newsstands, with an article whose timing was, from Johnson's point of view, unfortunate. Among the photographs accompanying the article, on the Big Rich of the Texas and Louisiana Gold Coasts, was a picture of the two Brown brothers, Herman and George, and the article reminded the Capitol that a tremendous item in which they, the Browns, have big holdings is Texas Eastern Transmission Company, owner and operator of the Big Inch and Little Inch pipelines. Although they are pretty sure that there is no such thing as good publicity, they are well known in select circles. These include potent people in Washington. They once put up $100,000 to back Lyndon Johnson for Congress. This, Lowell Mellett commented in the Washington Star, may explain the strange tangent taken by the subcommittee under Senator Johnson's chairmanship. The sense of betrayal was sharpest among those who had thought they knew Lyndon Johnson best, the small circle of liberal friends who for years at their dinner tables had heard him talk so eloquently about cheap electricity. Public power was a passion with him, and about the rapaciousness of the private utilities. This circle, in fact, included some of the lawyers who had helped him circumvent the law to keep the Senate seat he had won in such questionable circumstances, because they had believed that by helping him win, they were helping to bring a strong new liberal voice to the Senate. Decades later, Jim Rowe, who had long been tied psychologically as well as politically to Johnson's career, and who in many interviews with the author had defended unpleasant episodes in that career, at first tried to do the same with the Olds episode. In his thoughtful, understated manner, he said that he understood the reason for Johnson's determination to block Olds's renomination, because he wanted to solidify himself with the oil crowd in Texas. You cannot be a senator from Texas without making your peace with them. I don't think he liked doing it, but he was a pragmatic fellow. After talking in this vein for several minutes, however, Rowe paused and stared down at the desk in his paneled law office, and the pause lasted for some time. When he resumed talking, he did so in a different vein. While he could have accepted Johnson's blocking of Olds, he said, he had always found it difficult to accept Johnson's tactics. Speaking very slowly, with long halts between words, Rowe said, "He grabbed onto the goddamned commie thing and just ran with it and ran with it." There was another pause. "Just ran with it," Rowe said. "Ran it into the ground for no reason we could see." Rowe's partner, Tommy Corcoran, Johnson's chief fundraiser in liberal circles, but a man tied psychologically to no cause but his own, was to say, "I told him," Johnson, to his face one day, that I thought it was the rottenest thing he'd ever done, and that he could take it or leave it. The Commerce Committee did as dirty a job of trying to crucify this guy a la McCarthy as I have ever heard. Corcoran's sidekick, Ben Cohen, was always less loquacious than Tommy the Cork, but he could in his quiet way be equally eloquent. When asked about Johnson's tactics in the Olds fight, Cohen replied in a single word, "Shameful." For some other leading Washington liberals, less under Johnson's spell than Rowe or Corcoran, the shock was less severe, for his "We of the South" speech in March had forewarned them that all was not as they had believed. Joe Rao, who in 1948 had worked all night, along with Rowan Corcoran, on the legal briefs that persuaded Justice Hugo Black to issue the last-minute ruling that saved Johnson's election, says he had been disgusted by the speech, so that when Johnson's maneuvers against Olds were revealed, I wasn't surprised, I already knew. The tide had turned with Lyndon Johnson. Rao was not alone. He recalls that even before the Olds hearing, there were discussions. What's happened? This is not the shining New Deal fellow. The luster of winning the 1948 election went off pretty fast. Nonetheless, the speed and thoroughness of the transformation, as made clear in the Olds case, was startling. The election had, after all, been barely a year before. During the court fight over the contested election, Rao recalls, Corcoran called to get me on the defense team and said, "This wonderful congressman. In Abe Fortas's office, these people were talking about what a great man we were defending. I just sort of automatically assumed it." But it soon became clear that Johnson was not the shining knight that I was led to believe, that he was a totally different political figure than he had been in the Roosevelt days. I was quickly disabused of the notion that this was a New Deal guy, but it was the meanness of the use of these things, Olds's 1920s articles, that so attracted my attention. Leland Olds was a great American, Joe Rao says. What Johnson did to him was really vicious, one of the dirtiest pieces of work ever done. Rao says that I sort of felt dirty and double-crossed by Tommy. I goddamned Tommy for getting me to help. Opinion had turned even among the wives of the New Deal set who had been so charmed by the tall young congressman. "My, I wish I could have my campaign contribution back," Elizabeth Purcell, wife of SEC Chairman Ganson Purcell, said at one Georgetown party. Liberals attempted to organize. The effort had already started in the White House with Truman's letter, and now the president ordered Clark Clifford to mobilize support from New Deal names. Clifford asked Olds who he thought might help, and on a notepad on his desk, Leland Olds scribbled an address. 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. The address of the widow who bore the greatest name of all. And Clifford reported Eleanor Roosevelt's response. "Enthusiastic. We'll do it at once and discuss it later." Olds was evidently not sure that Mrs. Roosevelt even remembered him, writing her at Clifford's direction to give her details on the renomination battle. "The main line of attack has been an all-out effort to picture me as a communist. Unfortunately, our old friend Lyndon Johnson is supporting that point of view." He added a reminder of battles long past, as if feeling it necessary to identify himself. "You may recall that we presented the evidence which enabled Governor Roosevelt to start successful regulation in New York State," he wrote. And the letter's final sentences are sentences written by a man who, in dark days, is trying to remind himself of a time when days had been bright. "I had the never-to-be-forgotten privilege to play a small part in your husband's great work. I look back with a sense of happiness to the one or two instances when you invited us to join the family luncheon at the Executive Mansion, when Frank P. Walsh and I were seeing the governor on the St. Lawrence Project." Mrs. Roosevelt's next My Day column showed that she remembered. "I knew Mr. Olds when my husband was governor of New York State," she wrote. "He started his battle then for sound utility and power policy. Mr. Olds's work must have been well done because it brought about changes in the state. A program of effective national regulation was later secured by the Federal Power Commission when Mr. Olds himself was chairman of the commission." She had nothing but scorn, Eleanor Roosevelt said, for those who had raised the communist issue. "The horrible fact has been brought out that he once spoke on the same platform with Earl Browder. I don't know what that proves. Can't our senators and representatives see through this opposition and recognize honest public servants? Must they swallow such an obvious red herring allegation on communism?" Other friends were attempting to mobilize, friends who would have been working for Olds for months had someone contacted them. New York's Governor Lehman, under whom Olds had served, Morris Cook of the REA, Angus MacDonald of the National Farmers Union, Donald Montgomery of the CIO, Walter Monroe of the Trainmen, men whose support could have weighed heavily with senators. Many great names from the farmers' movement and the labor movement and from the New Deal had, as the tenor of the subcommittee hearings became clear, been telephoning the White House, wanting to help. And there were editorials in leading liberal newspapers around the country, some quite eloquent. Certain senators, the Louisville Courier-Journal said, have been able to make patriotism appear to be disloyalty and to make protest against wrong seem an act of revolution. But it was too late. The hearings and the subcommittee and committee vote were already fait accompli. The surprise had been total. Men who would have testified had not done so. Jerry Voorhis wrote a long statement on behalf of the National Cooperative League, but he wrote it after the hearings were over. Thanks to the thoroughness with which Johnson had selected the subcommittee's membership, moreover, there was no Senate supporter of Olds familiar with the testimony, and now, with the hearings over and the vote of the full Senate imminent, there was no senator who was organizing support to make an effective presentation on the Senate floor. During the same conversation in which Clifford told Olds that many want to do something, the White House aide also told Olds that his friends had no place to plug in. At one point, in a remark that points up vividly the disparity between Lyndon Johnson's operation and the effort the Olds supporters were attempting to start, Clifford had to remind Olds of the importance of accurate polling of the senators. And more time might not have helped. Max Lerner had been correct when he wrote in the New York Post about senators not daring to support Olds once the communist issue had been raised. Senator Toby's abrupt departure and failure to return to the hearing room had been a straw in the wind. On the day after the hearings, reporters polled senators and found only 29 who said they would vote for the president's nominee, a shockingly small number in a Senate containing 54 members of the president's party. Truman thereupon ordered Democratic National Chairman William M. Boyle, Jr. to send telegrams to all members of the Democratic National Committee and to state Democratic chairmen urging them to contact their senators and ask them to support Olds. Predictably, that maneuver backfired, for the Senate viewed Truman's effort as an attack on its cherished independence. A brazen effort, Andrew Scheppel of Kansas called it. Terming it a deliberate effort to threaten and coerce the members of the Senate, Harry Byrd said, "President Truman appears to believe that the United States Senate should be an adjunct to his own office, whereby he can issue orders as he pleases." So predictable was the Senate's reaction that more than one observer speculated that, in the words of Time magazine, Truman must have deliberately courted trouble. Reporters' polls showed that after Truman's attempt, the number of senators willing to vote for Olds dropped to 24. Leland Olds's nomination was dead. A simple voice or roll call vote would have killed it. But Lyndon Johnson didn't want a simple vote, for while he had won the Olds fight, he had not yet reaped from it the reward he wanted, recognition by the oil and natural gas industry that he was its savior and champion. The necessity to appear impartial in his role as subcommittee chairman had forced him to disguise the fact that he had organized and stage-managed the hearings, and the disguise had been so successful that his role had not been broadly publicized. Newspaper articles on the hearings had quoted Lyle or Bonner or Head, or when they quoted senators, the senators were Reed and Capehart. Johnson himself had not yet given them much to quote, and he needed a better stage, the Senate floor. At his request, a debate on the nomination was scheduled for an evening, Wednesday, October 12th, since the Senate's evening sessions were particularly dramatic. He himself would deliver a major address during it. He told Leslie Carpenter that it would be the most important speech of my life. Chapter 12. The Debate. Paul Douglas, not a member of the Commerce Committee and preoccupied with other issues in which he was taking a leading role, wanted to speak in support of Olds, although his administrative aide, Frank McCullough, recalls, because of past attacks on Douglas himself, as a left-winger, he suspected he might be a target himself if he did so. He had been waiting to hear from the nomination's floor manager until, on the very day of the debate, he realized that there was no floor manager, that little or no planning had gone into Olds's defense. "In the afternoon I made a canvass, found there was literally no one to speak for Olds," he was to recall. Attempting to round up speakers proved difficult. As the hour for the vote approached, a number of liberals suddenly discovered out-of-town engagements. Exactly four other senators, Morse of Oregon, Aiken of Vermont, Langer of North Dakota, and Humphrey of Minnesota, were willing to take the floor for the nominee. The five liberals who had the courage to rise in the Senate that evening knew they were going to lose. "The natural gas industry is moving heaven and earth to get Mr. Olds off the commission," Morse said, "and would succeed in doing so. I realize that Mr. Olds is not going to be approved by this body. I think there is no doubt about it," Aiken said. "The forces moving against Olds were too strong, and there are those who hope to see Mr. Olds destroyed." They had decided to defend him, the five speakers said, because of their outrage at the injustice that was being done to him. "When we are determining whether to reapprove a person who has been in public office, I think we should judge him by his work as a public official during the time he has been in office," Aiken said. "I do not think any of us would like to be judged entirely by what we did or said or wrote 20 or 30 years ago. I do not think Mr. Olds is going to be hurt by those who would crucify him, but I think a great many other folk are going to be. I think the effects of what is being done here tonight will echo down far through the years ahead of us. Certain public utilities are out to destroy a man for performing his duty. I do not know of anything worse than that." Langer said that the hearings held by a subcommittee headed by the distinguished senator from Texas had brought out nothing new. Old charges were dug up and dusted off again. Olds's long record in positions of public responsibility had been all but ignored. "I challenge senators to read the record from first page to last. They will not find a single word reflecting on his record." Hubert Humphrey was particularly eloquent. Olds had indeed criticized the American free enterprise system during the 1920s, Humphrey said. And, he said, "in the 1920s, the American enterprise system should have been criticized. If there is any room in heaven for a politician, the politician who will be in heaven is the one who had the courage to stand up and condemn the exploiters of child labor and of adult labor, the exploiters of the widows who put their money into phony stocks." Humphrey's voice rang with passion as he spoke. "If Mr. Olds had the courage to stand up in the 1920s and say that he did not like that kind of rotten business practice, God bless him. Those who should be on trial tonight are those who sat serenely and did not raise a finger of protest when millions of people were robbed, families were broken, homes were destroyed, and businesses were bankrupted. All they did was to talk about some kind of business confidence and prosperity around the corner and split up the loot. If there is any divine justice, those men will fry, and Mr. Olds will have a crown." And then, at 11:20 p.m., the subcommittee's chairman rose, laid his speech on a lectern that had been placed on his desk, and began to read. He took a moment to praise the impartiality with which he had conducted the hearings. "Every person who sought a hearing received a hearing. I believe senators will find the record is complete." And to raise the standard of senatorial independence against Truman's attempted intervention. And then he turned to Leland Olds, forgetting, as he did so, to be senatorial, so that the rest of Lyndon Johnson's speech, which lasted 50 minutes, was delivered in a hoarse, shouting voice. Johnson repeated all the charges that had been made against Olds, that the FPC chairman had schemed to substitute his own views for those of Congress, that he had substituted confiscation for regulation, that he had advocated the assumption of complete federal control of natural gas producers, that he had made vile and snide remarks to undermine and discredit members of the FPC who did not agree with him, conducting an insidious campaign of slander. Seizing on the remark he had finally elicited from Olds that if he was no longer a member of the commission and the anti-regulation commissioners thereby became the majority, the commission would not carry on as active a regulation policy, Lyndon Johnson quoted that statement to the Senate and interpreted it. "This indeed is a strange position," he shouted. "Here is a man declaring publicly and proudly that his colleagues on the commission are virtually unworthy of the public confidence, declaring that he and he alone is capable and willing to defend the public interest." Then he turned to the hearings, portraying them in a light that would have been startling to anyone who had been present at them, as if their focus had not been natural gas at all, but rather electric power, defining the words special interests and power interest and utilities, as if the interests involved were not oil and natural gas, but electric cooperatives and companies. By using this definition, Johnson was able to say that the power interests had not opposed Olds, as newspapers had charged, but rather had supported him. During the hearings, he said, not a single representative of power interests appeared to oppose Mr. Olds. The only representative of any utility who did appear came to testify in behalf of Mr. Olds. Hundreds of telegrams and letters have come to my office the past few days opposing Mr. Olds's confirmation. Not one has been signed by a representative of the electric utilities. But, Johnson said, these forces have been at work on behalf of Mr. Olds. Is it not self-evident that for favors granted, for services rendered, these dragons of special privilege, which Leland Olds supposedly combats three times daily and twice on Sundays, are now log-rolling in the oldest of Washington traditions, seeking for Leland Olds what both he and they so desperately need? An attempt has been made to blackmail Congress into accepting his appointment through the simple device of charging all who oppose Leland Olds with being tools of special interests, many of which are actually supporting his nomination, and he knows it. And then, a few minutes after midnight, Lyndon Johnson came to the heart of his speech. It began with a disclaimer, "I do not charge that Mr. Olds is a communist," but continued with phrases that were clearly intended to keep that possibility alive in the minds of his listeners. "I do not charge that Mr. Olds is a communist. No member of the subcommittee made any such accusation. I realize that the line he followed, the phrases he used, the causes he espoused resemble the party line today, but the communist tie is not the tie that binds Leland Olds's writings of the 1920s to his doctrines of the 1940s. Rather, Johnson said, that tie was an unmistakably clear purpose. Leland Olds had something in mind when he began to build his political empire across the nation. He had something in mind when he chose to force a showdown with the Senate over his power to write laws of his own. He had something in mind when he chose to disregard the clear language of the Natural Gas Act and plot a course toward confiscation and public ownership. The purpose, Johnson said, had become clear in the 1920s. Leland Olds chose, Johnson said, to travel with those who proposed the Marxian answer. His choice was not dictated by necessity. The company he chose of his own free will. He spoke from the same platforms with Earl Browder. He accepted subsidy from the so-called Garland Fund, a fund created and expended to keep alive Marxist organs and Marxist groups. And why did these writings stop in 1929? Johnson asked. Only, he said, because Leland Olds, the advocate, Leland Olds, the man with a purpose, found he could advance that purpose more successfully from within the government. There he has been ever since, Lyndon Johnson told the Senate. From 1929 to 1949, discretion has stilled Leland Olds's pen. His purpose and his methods have found sanctuary in the legalistic prose of commission opinions, prose which affects many more men than the Federated Press affected. There can be no question about the environment, the trend of thought, the bent of mind of Leland Olds, Johnson said. The issue, he said, was clear-cut. Shall we have a commissioner or a commissar? Lyndon Johnson's speech put the finishing touches on the portrait of Leland Olds that he had been painting for the Senate. The debate, as is seldom the case, did change some minds, one reporter wrote. Aired not in private or in a subcommittee hearing, but on the Senate floor, the charges echoed with a heightened authority. And Johnson's new hint that Olds might have had some insidious plot in mind, that he had stopped writing because he could more effectively accomplish confiscation and public ownership from within the government, evidently made some liberal senators who had determined to stand up for Olds, whatever the consequences, reconsider. It took a brave senator to vote for a man who had been fingered, as Johnson fingered Olds in a committee and as he now did again, even more brutally, in the closing hours of that day on the Senate floor, Robert Sherrill was to write. Says Professor Harris, most senators were far less interested in determining the accuracy of every accusation against Olds than they were in letting the public know and having the record show that they themselves did not vote for a man who was accused of being a communist. While Johnson was speaking, with his accusations, Marxian, Earl Browder, Marxist, Commissar, rolling across the rows of Senate desks, a number of liberal senators quietly rose and left and did not return for the vote. When the clerk called the yeas and nays, only 13 Democrats voted yea, along with two Republicans. Leland Olds's renomination was defeated by a vote of 53-15. When the clerk announced those figures, a reporter wrote, "There was a moment of stunned silence at the overwhelming size of the vote." In what the Washington Star said was, "about as severe a political licking as any president ever got on a nominee," Truman had been able to persuade only 15 of 96 senators to support the official he recommended, an official who had already held his job for 10 years, an official whose work many senators had come to know and to respect, as, over 10 years, they had come to know and respect the man himself. On Capitol Hill and throughout political Washington, the vote was viewed as a personal triumph for Lyndon Johnson. It's not just every day in the week that a freshman senator can oppose his president, the chairman of his party, governors, mayors, national committeemen, and others, and come out with a 53-15 victory, one senator told a reporter. Lyndon Johnson almost alone was responsible for the defeat, Joseph Rao said. And he did that as a freshman senator. John Gunther, making his rounds of Capitol Hill offices to lobby for ADA causes, said, "During the next couple of weeks walking around the Hill, it became clear that people were a little scared of Lyndon Johnson. All of a sudden, he was big." One aspect of the triumph made it especially significant. Dissatisfied with the attendance as Johnson was rising to speak, the two giants from Georgia glanced at each other, and then rose and walked together out of the chamber to summon other senators. Before long, and well before the crucial "commissar" line was uttered, the number of senators listening to Johnson, even after the discreet liberals had left, was quite respectable. After the speech, Richard Russell was beaming. As always, he hung back, but Walter George, the Senate's most renowned speechmaker, hurried over and told Johnson, "I've never heard a more masterful speech against a nomination." And Southerners, along with some conservative Republicans, lined up to shake Johnson's hand, as they had done after his maiden speech in March. The strident anti-communism of Johnson's rhetoric may have grated on liberals, but it didn't grate on Southerners, most of whom were as fervently anti-communist as even Johnson could have wished. During his first year in the Senate, Johnson had delivered two major speeches. The first, in March, had announced his enlistment in the ranks of the Southerners who ran the Senate. The second had demonstrated that he could be an effective leader in their causes. "In the minds of many," Lowell Mellett wrote, "the shame of the Senate, in the session now ending, has been written in oil. By a sneak attack on Leland Olds's personal reputation, the sure-fire smear technique of labeling him a communist or communist sympathizer." But the columnist's analysis also noted that the Southern bloc emerged from the session stronger than ever. Victory was a word used in banner headlines all over Texas, and the state's newspapers made clear it was Lyndon Johnson's victory. In a score of articles, he was identified as Lyndon Johnson, who led the fight against Leland Olds. And, the newspapers told Texans, it was a victory that had required great political courage. In his speech, Johnson had portrayed himself as a lone crusader fighting overwhelming forces. The president, the Democratic National Committee, and, of course, those dragons of special privilege bringing immense pressure to bear for Leland Olds. "The lash of a party line can be painful," he said. "I do not relish disagreeing with my president and being unable to comply with the chairman of my party, but I can find no comfort in failing to do what I know is right." The big Texas newspapers, many of whose publishers had substantial oil and natural gas interests, took the point.
End of Disc 13.